The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're starting another week of broadcasting here on KPCG.fm. If you listen to the live stream, of course, you can also get the live over-the-air broadcast there in North Edmond, right around our headquarters campus in Oklahoma City, or just north of Oklahoma City, in the heart of Oklahoma. If you'd like to email the program, you can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, on today's show, we've got quite a number of things to get through. We'll be talking about communism. We'll bring up Christmas. Today is the anniversary of Mozart's death, so we'll spend some time on that. We'll play some opera clips, not from Mozart. We'll also talk about the criminal justice system here in just a bit, and if we have time, hopefully we can also get through a few more listener emails that have come in. So if you're interested in variety, then today's show is for you. Actually, I think I want to focus, if there is a theme, I guess, that can bring a lot of this together. I want to talk a little bit about the youth. I think you'll see with this criminal justice piece, and then also even Mozart. I know we've talked about him in previous programs, particularly over the summer, and just some of the influences that opera has had on me in recent months, and my family, and my children. So hopefully we can weave all of this together as the week unfolds. We'll probably spend more time on just some of the more dramatic events happening in Europe with Renzi's resignation. And then also Austria had elections yesterday. This far-right candidate months ago came close to winning, and then they had the runoff, and then he lost this time around. So Europe, to be sure, is in turmoil, and you can just feel, you can sense the continent crying out for a strong leader, a strong man, to keep it all together. We know that it's that mixture of iron and clay. The Bible tells us, it told us thousands of years ago that it would be like this. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise, all of these crises, as they just keep mounting. But you can be sure that the Daniel 8 man will come to the fore. And once he does, those 10 kings, as Revelation 17 says, those 10 kings will come together for a short time and give their minds over, their power over to the beast. That's what your Bible says. That's what Bible prophecy tells us. Well, I'll get to this this criminal justice system story here in just a second, but I guess I have to say just a comment or two about Fidel Castro's funeral. You may have seen the news on Saturday where the Jeep carrying Castro's ashes, it broke down and had to be pushed along the parade route by soldiers. Seriously, this is not from The Onion. And if you think, I mean, really, could there be anything that better illustrates Castro's 50-year reign in Cuba than his own hearse breaking down on the way to the burial? A perfect illustration, really. And we talked about this a week ago on that program. Never mind how world leaders responded. I mean, he basically turned Cuba into a broken Jeep over the course of his 50-year reign. And there should be more leaders stepping up to point this out. Ronald Reagan did back in 1983. I wish we had the audio for this. But this is a speech he gave on May 20th, 1983, where he said that there were 10 million people at the time in Cuba, 10 million people still living there, and that compared to about 1 million Cuban Americans. So there were 1 million Cubans in the United States, 1/10 of the population in Cuba. And Mr. Reagan said these are people with the same traditions and cultural heritage. And yet, as he went on to say in the speech, the Cubans in the United States, with only 1/10 the number, produce almost 2 times the wealth of those they left behind. So 1/10, 10%, a tithe of the Cubans here in the States were able to produce twice as much as those they left behind. And Reagan went on to say, so don't let anyone fool you. He said, what's happening in Cuba is not a failure of the Cuban people. It's a failure of Fidel Castro and of communism. He mentioned that here that little island, Cuba, it had the full backing of the Soviet Union, all of the military might of the Soviet Union, and all of those massive subsidies that the Soviet Union provided the Cuban economy, and still Cuba couldn't make any kind of a prosperous system or anything work in a prosperous sense. And that's because of the reign of repression and terror coming from Castro on down. Reagan said the truth. He spoke the truth in 1983. And you compare it with what so many world leaders were saying last week following Castro's death. I mean, Cuba, under his rule, Cuba broke down like that Jeep on the parade route just on the weekend, Saturday. And yet, if you listened to world leaders last week, you would have thought Castro created this island paradise down there. It was hardly that. It was nothing like that. Reagan told a joke in that 1983 speech about the stories, as he said, that Russian people tell each other. He said it's a story of a commissar who visited one of their collective farms. And he stopped the first farmer or the first workman that he met, and he asked about life on the farm, and the man said, oh, it's wonderful. I've never heard anyone complain about anything since I've been here. And the commissar then said, well, what about the crops? Oh, he said, the crops are wonderful. What about the potatoes? He asked. Oh, sir, the potatoes. The potatoes, there are so many that if you put them in one pile, they would touch the foot of God. And the commissar said, just a minute, sir. In the Soviet Union, there is no God. And the farmer said, well, there are no potatoes either. That was President Reagan with his characteristic wit to make just a devastating point about the effect of communism on Cuba. It destroyed that nation. And the Cuban people suffered under the rule of Castro. Reagan said in 1983, the declining Castro economy continues to make a grotesque joke out of the ideological claims that Marxism is for the people. It's for the people. Everyone benefits. Share the wealth. It says nearly a quarter of a century after the Cuban Revolution, the Cuban people continue to face shortages. This is Reagan in 1983. Shortages and rationing of basic necessities. Once one of the most prosperous countries in all of Latin America, it's rapidly becoming the most economically backward in the region, thanks to the communist system. We brought this out again a week ago, even playing, if you recall, a couple of audio clips from one of those old short radio programs that Ronald Reagan delivered back in the late 70s before becoming president. He said it's economically backward because of the communist system. And then he went on to say, and here again, this is him as president. I mean, he had the most powerful office in the world at the time, and he said this about Cuba. There's strong evidence that Castro officials are involved in the drug trade, peddling drugs like criminals, profiting on the misery of the addicted. And I would like to take this opportunity to call on the Castro regime for an accounting, he said. I'd like to call on this regime for an accounting. I mean, the thugs in the regime are out there peddling drugs like criminals. These were government officials in Castro's regime. Castro himself being most responsible. It's pretty amazing what kind of a message you can get across if you just have the courage to stand up and speak the truth. And speak the truth. Few world leaders will do that today. And so that's why lies spread so fast. And then young people, they just swallow it all without even considering proving it, proving whether it's true. I mentioned that video, I think I did on if I didn't over the air here, I did to one of my classes last week, this video that was circulating in the States with young people on college campuses talking about how they could really respect Fidel Castro. They held him in higher esteem than Donald Trump. Because, well, take what they're learning on the university campus or in the college classroom, what they're getting from their professors, the leaders in the university environment, telling them that, well, this was an island paradise that he created starting in 1959. And then look at it today. Look at the social programs. Look at the educational system. Look at the healthcare system. In fact, the whole system in Cuba was broken. And so, as I say, what better way to illustrate that than seeing a broken down Jeep carrying Castro's ashes rolling through, well, not exactly rolling, through Cuba on Saturday. This piece here in the Washington Post that I mentioned earlier, this is about second chance law for young criminals and how it's putting violent offenders back on the D.C. streets. And it's going back and analyzing really the data from a law that was passed in Washington, D.C. back in the mid-1980s, I think it was, under then Mayor Marion Barry. And it's important today, given the fact that the current presidential administration, President Obama, has just been letting out violent offenders right and left. But this thinking, I mean, it goes deep into the criminal justice system that, well, we've got to open the doors and just let people out and give them another chance. And this is the Washington Post finding out that, well, doing so, it just puts these violent criminals back on the street. And it's killing people. This program is literally killing people. It says here, this is from December 3rd, hundreds of criminals sentenced by D.C. judges under an obscure local law crafted to give second chances to young adult offenders have gone on to rob, rape, or kill residents of the nation's capital. I mean, this is happening right in Washington, D.C., right in the nation's capital, one of the most violent, one of the most dangerous cities in the United States. It's right up there with Chicago and others. It says the original intent of the law was to rehabilitate inexperienced criminals under the age of 22. That was the intent. Well, we'll rehabilitate them, and we want to give them a second chance. And if they get a felony on their record, I mean, that just pretty much, it mars their record or just their life from that point forward. So let's go easier on them. Let's give them a slap on the wrist. Let's lock them up for a few months and then clear the record and then give them another chance. It sounds reasonable. I mean, it's intended to rehabilitate. I mean, who could criticize a program that's aimed to rehabilitate young people? The district's Youth Rehabilitation Act allows for shorter sentences for some crimes and an opportunity for offenders to emerge with no criminal record. But the Washington Post investigation has found a pattern of violent offenders returning rapidly to the streets and committing more crimes. Hundreds have been sentenced under the act multiple times. Hundreds of young people roaming the streets of D.C. and being sentenced under this Youth Rehabilitation Act multiple times. In dozens of cases, it says D.C. judges were able to hand down Youth Act sentences shorter than those called for under mandatory minimum laws designed to deter armed robberies and other violent crimes. The criminals have often repaid that leniency by escalating their crimes of violence upon release. See, they're doing this at a time when there's just been a total breakdown in the family, particularly in the inner cities. Fatherless America, let these criminals go. These young men, these young people, let them go back out onto the streets and hope for the best. And those young criminals are repaying that leniency with ever more violent crimes. That's what's happening. It says in 2013, four masked men entered a home of a family in northeast Washington, held them at gunpoint, and ransacked the house. One of the invaders was sentenced under the Youth Act. He was released on probation in 2015. Almost exactly a year later, this same individual, after this violent robbery, this same individual shot a woman, killed a woman. She died 9 days later. And then it quotes this woman's aunt, "You're telling me you can come back out onto the streets and rob again, hold people hostage again, kill again because of the Youth Act? It's all for the youths. It's all for the young people. It's all to rehabilitate the younger generation." Well, it says about this killer that he's one of at least 121 defendants sentenced under the Youth Act who've gone on to be charged with murder. Murder, not robbery. They didn't go back to smoking marijuana, these individuals. 121 sentenced under the Youth Act have gone on to be charged with murder. 121 people have been murdered by these youths that have been let out early because they need a second chance. It says here, since 2010, that's just in the last 5-6 years. Four of the slayings, including the killing of Dodds, occurred while the defendants could still have been incarcerated for previous crimes under mandatory minimum sentencing. And 30 of the killings took place while the suspects were on probation. It says here, Youth Act offenders accounted for 1 in 5 suspects arrested on homicide charges in the district since 2010, a period that has seen a recent surge in homicides and growing public concern about repeat violent offenders. See, violence in Washington, D.C., it's skyrocketing like other big cities in the U.S., and now people are there saying, well, look, what do you mean? They're repeat offenders. Why aren't these guys in jail in the first place? It says the cycle of violence has been largely shrouded from public view or oversight. D.C. judges do not track the use of the law, which provides a collection of benefits to violent felons that experts say does not exist anywhere else in the country. So the judges, they let them go, and they don't track the use of the law. There's no data there for them to analyze. They just know that, well, the law was passed in 1985, and we're supposed to be lenient. And there's a good reason for it, because they have a second chance, and they can go out and rehabilitate. I mean, this is just classic. I mean, classic human nature running its course. There's a way, like the proverb says, there's a way that seems right to a man. It seems right. It seems merciful. It seems tolerant. And how does it work out in the end? Well, were it not for this study by the Washington Post, we still probably wouldn't know. In fact, so many of these killers, they've been in jail before. Here's an explanation of this act from 1984 or 5. It says, after a young adult is convicted of a crime, the Youth Act allows judges to decide whether the offender can benefit from rehabilitation and should receive special treatment. The law gives felons a chance to have their convictions expunged from the public record if they serve out their sentences or complete their probation. Because of the way the law was written, Youth Act offenders also can avoid mandatory prison time for certain violent gun crimes. The Post also found that judges applying the Youth Act generally give lighter sentences across the board. These are just liberal judges that are giving lighter sentences right across the board, and letting murderers and rapists return back to the streets. The law was enacted in 1985 during the mayoral administration of Marion Barry, a Democrat, at the time when jails were being filled with young men charged with drug crimes in an attempt to protect African American youths from the stigma of lengthy prison sentences. So there's a stigma there that African American youths are in jail for long periods of time. So to remove the stigma, we have to shorten the sentences. That's the kind of logic that you see politicians using today. And really, as I say, President Obama is using or taking the same approach with the many commutations, with the illegals that he's let out of jail. It says, we have value in this city that youthful offenders should be rehabilitated. But I don't think anybody expects leniency for violent criminals. That's quoting the current mayor. Okay, it makes sense to try to rehabilitate, but we can't just be lenient with these violent criminals. It says the judges declined the Post's request for interviews and also declined to comment about specific cases. Surprise, surprise. They let all these criminals go. 121 people are murdered by those who've been let go. And then the judges all of a sudden have nothing to say. Mum's the word. No comment. It says in a written statement, the judges said that they weigh many factors in sentencing, including the ages of offenders and the effect of their crimes on the victims. It says here, finally, in considering whether to sentence a young man under the Youth Act, generally, judges are aware that a felony conviction can create lifelong obstacles to becoming a good and productive citizen. And so to remove the obstacle to being a good and productive citizen, they let someone out who's not a good and productive citizen to then continue with the killing rampage or the robbery rampage. What a system. Does it need to be reformed? I mean, rehabilitation is coming. And certainly there's a lot to be said for repentance, and that will be in God's system of judgment and justice. There is a way to rehabilitate, but it's going to take the government of God ruling over our cities. As it is, you have this kind of policy in a society where the family is completely broken down. It's just like throwing fuel on the fire in our inner cities, right in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Your Bible says that in the end time, God would give children to be the princes. Babes are going to rule over us. That's dangerous. You start turning loose 18, 19, 20-year-olds that have shown by their history, by their fruits, that they're violent, that they're a threat to society. You talk about oppression. God says, as for my people, children are their oppressors. Children are their oppressors. Herbert Armstrong wrote back in 1964. You talk about being way ahead of his time. He wrote in 1964, few people stop to realize to what extent the teenagers have taken over. They pretty well dominate the world picture. And then he goes on and gives the facts from 1964. Teenagers have pretty well taken over. That's what Isaiah 3 and verse 12 is saying. And he talks about how that influence coming from teens, it primarily goes in two directions. Sexual influence and violence. sex and violence. He says here, this is God speaks out on the new morality. The fast-growing surge of teenage immorality, drugs, and violence is worldwide. Accompanying sexual promiscuity, news dispatches pile up an avalanche of reports of wreckage, destruction of property, especially schools, pillaging, arson, violence, and often murder. That's Herbert Armstrong writing in 1964. And so much of what we see today, just like with so many of the other prophecies that we comment on, so much of what we see today, it's proving just how right he was. He was right. He was right. Just like our booklet says. He writes further, the world doesn't want to hear the true answer. I mean, what's the solution to this? How do you solve this crisis? How do we rehabilitate our young people? He says the world refuses to face the tragic truth. The true answer is this: something has been taken away from this earth that sorely needs to be restored. That something is knowledge of, respect for, and obedience to the government and law of God. But will any like that answer? Most want to go on rebelling against their maker, trying to find some other solution to their problems. There is no other. There's no other solution except this one, and this is the one the judicial systems reject. This is the one parents reject. This is the one even the traditional world of Christianity rejects. And so we're left to try to come up with all of these new, very modern policies to fix the problem, to fix the many problems on our streets. Rehabilitate. One more passage here. This is Hosea 4. I read this recently. Hosea 4 talks about the violence in our land, the violence in our cities. It says God has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land because there's no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. By swearing, verse 2, Hosea 4, 2, by swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out and blood touches blood. See, violence. Teenage influence, predominantly sex and violence. Blood touches blood. God says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And he says, when we reject knowledge, godly knowledge, then he rejects us. If we forget God's laws, then he's going to forget our children. And that's what we're doing. We've forgotten God, as I said a couple of weeks ago, right before Thanksgiving in the United States. We've forgotten God. And now look at what our cities are turning into. Look at our capital city in the United States, Washington, D.C. All of this violence, blood touching blood. Verse 7 of Hosea 4 says, as they were increased, so they sinned against me. Therefore will I change their glory into shame. What a shame it is to see the upside down society, to see the broken family. Our people who've been the recipients of so many of these wonderful, incredible blessings. And yet what happens when we forget about God, the source of those blessings? Well, read Hosea 4, study it further. We have more to talk about it, or to say on it, in our booklet, our Hosea booklet. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program as the week unfolds. You can send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Well, speaking of God's knowledge and not rejecting it, we had an effective program over the weekend, and as it turns out, it was a repeat. It was one that we put together a year ago, What You Should Know About Christmas. And it brought in 212 requests for the literature. I believe we offered, we have a little Christmas booklet, and we might have offered one other piece of literature too. I can't remember. In any event, a big response coming in for a repeat program. Of course, it plays at the perfect time right here in early December, where the Christmas craze is in full motion. Here's a program about what you should know about this worldly holiday. 212 requests. It's been, a month or two since we've been up over 200. So really good to see that kind of a response. Well, as I said at the top of the show, today is the anniversary of Mozart's death in 1791. Earlier this year, over the summer, I talked about my family's visit to Austria, Salzburg in particular, where we were able to see Mozart's birthplace and residence, and a lot of these memories came right back into mind here recently, when quite a few of our students also made their way down to Austria just a week or two ago, and saw some of the same sights that my family did back in June. And as I've mentioned previously on this program, as young as he was, he died at the age of 35. It's just amazing to consider the large body of work produced by Mozart in such a short period of time. I mean, this was a genius and a tireless worker, a man who really did drive himself. Haydn said about Mozart, "I tell you before God, as an honest man," he was writing this to Mozart's dad, "your son is the greatest composer known to me in person and by name. It's the greatest I've ever seen." He was a remarkable young man as well, being groomed for this career, composing music at the age of 5, giving piano and violin performances when he was a small boy, at the age of 8 and 9. And as I've noted previously, you can study into Mozart's life and see just how much of an influence his father, Leopold, had on him. In the Life of Mozart by Edward Holmes, it says the wonder that his talents created and the applause that he received had no ill effects. He remained a simple and affectionate child, free from vanity, dutiful to his parents, who governed him rather by looks than words, and so obliging that how long soever he might have played, he was always ready to return to the instrument without a murmur if his father desired it. It's time for you to go practice. It's time for you to go work on your craft. This book then goes on and describes this little singing ritual that the young Mozart carried out each night with his father before he went off to bed. It says here, between the singing and after it, he would kiss his father on the tip of the nose, and having thus expressed his childish affections, go quietly and contentedly to bed. This custom was observed till he had passed his ninth year. For his father and instructor, who appeared in every point of view, in the light that commanded respect, he cherished sentiments of veneration. And one of his most ordinary sayings was, God first, and then Papa. First God, then the father of the home. We can see why he drove himself the way that he did. His father was a brilliant man in his own right. And so Mozart worked tirelessly for those 35 years, growing up under the authority of a famous composer and performer himself, his dad, his father Leopold. It says here, this is another book by Alex Ross on Mozart, that says, ambitious parents who are currently playing the baby Mozart video for their toddlers may be disappointed to learn that Mozart became Mozart by working furiously hard. He was a hard worker. He wasn't just born with this genius. He learned it. He learned it at the feet of his father. You think about what the Bible says about the responsibilities that parents have, that fathers have. Psalm 45:16 says, instead of your fathers shall be your children, whom you, fathers, parents, shall make princes in all the earth. Notice the emphasis on make. We make them. My father wrote in the Key of David booklet, he said, we must continually remind our young people that they are God's princes and princesses of the earth. They must be taught and encouraged to uphold that royal standard, to act like God's royalty today. What happens, though, when the family's turned upside down, when the fathers disappear? Well, look at our society. Look at our cities. Look at our streets. You shall make them princes in all the earth. Pretty amazing what can be done. What you can produce in your home if you're diligent. I think I've given this quote before as well from the John Quincy Adams book by James Traub. He says, what is clear in any case is that both poured themselves into the raising of their eldest son. This is talking about John and Abigail. Both of them poured themselves into the raising of their eldest son, and that he dutifully, indeed reverently, absorbed their lessons and their example. He became what they wished him to be. John Quincy Adams became what his parents wished him to be. Now, this is a president. He may not be the president that makes the top of the list as far as the greatest ever, but I think it was historian David McCullough who said, without question, he was the most brilliant man to ever occupy the White House, just because of his education, his upbringing. This book says both John and Abigail regarded the upbringing of children as a sacred and solemn obligation. Abigail and John would have recoiled at the idea that intellect could be taught in the absence of morality, for they believed that the goal of education was to produce both goodness and usefulness. It's both. See, character and competence. We need both. We need the character, the godly character. And then we need the competence. We need the education. We need the knowledge. You look at all that, as my father went on to say in that Key of David booklet, you look at all of the resources that Mr. Armstrong used to help the young people of the church. It's all about family, whether you look at it in the spiritual sense or the physical. It all revolves around family, because God is a family. That's what we're here to build. That's the main lesson we've got to get across to our children, that they're part of the family of God, that they have a role in this family vision. It's a sobering responsibility for sure. Or to quote again from that book I just gave to you, it's a solemn obligation. It certainly is. And yet when done right, what an impact. What an impact, fathers, parents, what an impact that they can have on their household. Joshua 24 and verse 15, it quotes there about Joshua saying, well, he's giving this ultimatum to the people of Israel. And then Joshua says, as for me and my house, we're going to serve God. That's what my house is doing. I'm the leader. I'm responsible for my children. And this is the direction we're going. There's a proverb that says, train up the child in the way that he should go. He should know that he's not going to go out and live on the streets. He should know that he's not going to rob and hurt and maim people. He should know that he's not going to kill another human being. He's been taught, he's been trained in the way that he should go. And the proverb goes on to say that when he's old, he won't depart away from it. Well, in the example of Mozart, he really was taught from a very young age in his particular field, and he embraced it, and he worked hard at it. And that was, as it turns out, that was a very productive life, a very productive physical life, in the musical sense, fine music at that. And just 35 years, look at what he was able to accomplish. Well, speaking of music, I was able to take my family to another opera this past weekend. Puccini's Tosca, I guess that's one of his most performed operas. This is a bit more recent than Mozart. I think the opera was written around about 1900 or so, so a little over a century old. We were running a little late to the show and got in about halfway through the first act, and I know I've told you before about or suggested that if you have a chance to go to the opera, and by the way, the young people that went down to Austria a couple of weeks ago, they were able to get in and see an opera, one of Mozart's opera, and they came back pretty pumped up over that experience. Following the encouragement that I've tried to give in recent months, I've gotten emails and letters from others who've attended an opera in Virginia and South Africa, people trying to enhance their cultural education, and it's been great to see that. That said, the downside to the opera always is the story. The stories are just appalling in some ways. This one in particular was maybe not one of the worst. But it has a Romeo and Juliet type theme where everyone dies at the end. But if you can brush aside the silliness of the story itself, the music is something to behold. So we got there about halfway through the first act, and I was saying a few months ago that if you have the chance to do some research and to kind of know a little bit about what the opera's about, a little bit about the composer, and yes, even the story, as silly or as dumb as those might be, it really does help to hold your attention going in and sitting down and listening to this story as it plays out with such beautiful music. This was one I didn't have time to do that for, so we went in kind of blind. We didn't know too much about the story, and so I guess our expectations were a bit lower than for some of the others we've seen this past year. And then as it unfolded before our eyes, we were pleasantly surprised. It was very traditional. They didn't try to modernize it, which in these days it makes it a lot worse than even the way the original story was written. In any event, it was fairly traditional and just, again, beautiful sets at the London Coliseum. And then the music, I don't have the names of the performers, but you're probably familiar with the two names of these that I'll play for you here in a second. The first one is I think it's the longer clip, Sam, the one by the soprano. This is in the middle of Act 2 of this this opera, and basically this is Tosca. She's the main character in the play or in the opera, and she's mourning the loss of her beloved, or he's not yet lost, he's not yet gone, but he's incarcerated. Things are going south for her, and in this song, in this particular piece, it's titled Vissi d'arti, or the English translation is I Lived for My Art, and she's singing in this song about how her life was about art and so on, and how that because things started to take a turn for the worse, it seemed like God had abandoned her. So here is Maria Callas singing Vissi d'arti. This is from many years ago. Maria Callas singing as Tosca, the main character in Puccini's Tosca from 1900, singing about how she always had sincere faith, she gave her prayers, she rose to the holy tabernacles. That's one of the lines in the song, always had sincere faith, decorated the altars with flowers. And now in this hour of grief, why has God brought these these many curses upon me? That's her singing, as I say, from a number of years ago. Perhaps the most famous song in the opera. That was one that I was somewhat familiar with going in. So when I got the program and realized we missed the first half of Act One, I hurriedly tried to figure out, okay, when's this famous song coming? Because I don't want to miss it. And it comes right in the middle of Act Two, so we heard it. And by the way, if you go to the opera in the London Coliseum, most of the operas there are performed in English. But it still has the subtitles right above the stage in case you can't understand even in English, and sometimes that is challenging given what they're singing and just the way they move around and such. But in any event, if you go there, it's in English, and typically if you go to the Royal Opera House, which I've been to once or twice, then those are performed in the original language, usually Italian. Just an aside in case you get the chance to see an opera in central London. This next piece here, it comes from Act 3, and this was a real stunner because I wasn't familiar with this song. I've since come to find out that it's also one of the more famous songs from this opera. It's titled Illusivan Listel, I believe, which means "And the Stars Were Shining." And this is the significant other in Tosca's life, the man she loves, Mario. He's the painter who's in prison. And, well, I won't get into the story. As I say, everyone ends up dying in the end. In any event, it's toward the end of the opera where Mario is lamenting the fact that he's not going to be seeing Tosca again. And this particular song is sung, this is from 1990, so it's a fairly, I guess, fairly old rendition from 26 years ago. And this is performed by Plácido Domingo. Clap along if you like. It's obviously from a live performance, part of the three tenors performance, in fact, from 1990. Plácido Domingo performing Illusvan Listel, or Stell, "The Stars Were Shining." When the stars were brightly shining and faint perfumes the air pervaded, and on it goes about his love for Tosca. That one blew me away in the third act of that performance over the weekend in central London. Well, I thought I'd close with at least one email. I think we have time for a couple, but this one in particular, I'll read it just because it did provide me with some encouragement. Even this morning, as I'm coming out of epistles, it's always a little bit harder to finish up with class and to work with a shorter period of time to put the material together. But this particular email came in, and it's one of the listeners that says that he's excited for today's program. So that gave me a little extra oomph in my step as far as getting the material together. And he says at the start here, I want to especially thank you for bringing all of us into your classroom. Learning about what is being taught in God's colleges has really added to my excitement. I've now studied more into and around 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5. That's the verse about bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. We went through that in Epistles of Paul last week in class, and then also touched on that in one of the radio shows last week as well. He writes, I even applied this today. Actually, I didn't write it down. It could be a female listener. In any event, I even applied this today. I cheerfully said hello to a couple at the store today. However, my kindness was foreign and unwelcome. The man said nothing, and the woman reluctantly responded with some profanity. This made the aisle quite awkward. Naturally, I wanted to clear my throat in arrogant pride or sigh aloud so he could hear it. After a moment, my mind had an even worse idea: to confront the man. Ignoring those fleshly ideas, I knew this was a simple opportunity to build character and embrace God's promises. It says, I left, and it did not hinder me from being equally kind and loving to the next person. And then he says, I'm excited for today's program. So thank you for that. And thank you for listening along to yet another Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, just send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.